Hello, everyone. This is Bob Zeta. My amateur radio call sign is N1BLF, November 1, Bravo Lima Foxtrot. We'll be reading together today in digest format CQ Magazine for the month of April 2011. CQ is published by CQ Communications Incorporated, 25 Newbridge Road, Hicksville, New York, 11801. This recording is a production of the Courage Handyham System, 3915 Golden Valley Road, Golden Valley, Minnesota, 55422. It is for the use of eligible Handyham members only. Any other use may violate copyright laws. Handyhams may be reached at area 763-520-0512 or at email address handyham@courage.org. Our website, www.handyham.org. We'll begin today with Ham Radio News. The launch of ARISSAT-1, that's AirSat-1, currently on board the International Space Station, has been delayed until July. The satellite was initially scheduled to be hand-launched by the ISS crew during a spacewalk in mid-February. However, a change in the work schedule for the February spacewalk pushed back the AirSat launch, and the ham community was initially told it would be launched in April, to coincide with the 50th anniversary of the first manned space flight by Yuri Gagarin. News received at press time, however, indicates that the next spacewalk by ISS crew now will not take place until July at the earliest. Ham station dedicated at McAuliffe Shepard Discovery Center. A fully functional ham radio station has been installed as part of the hands-on exhibits at the McAuliffe Shepard Discovery Center in Concord, New Hampshire. The station, KA1SKY, Kilo Alpha 1 Sierra Kilo Yankee, was a gift from NEAR Fest, that's the New England Amateur Radio Festival, and will be operated by volunteers from the Contacook Valley Radio Club. It is set up for both voice and Morse code operation on all bands from 160 meters into the microwaves and is capable of making contact via amateur satellites and potentially with the International Space Station. The station was dedicated on February 14. The McAuliffe Shepard Discovery Center is named in memory of teacher in space Krista McAuliffe, who was killed in the explosion of the Shuttle Challenger, and of America's first space traveler, Alan Shepard. Both were natives of New Hampshire. Interoperable broadband on front burner. Ham Bam may be threatened. Creating a nationwide interoperable broadband network for emergency responders has emerged as a high priority item for both the FCC and the new session of Congress. And one bill introduced by a powerful House committee chairman could endanger the 70-centimeter amateur band. Virtually all plans involve dedicating certain frequencies in the 700 megahertz band to creating the network. These frequencies were freed up by the migration of television broadcasting from analog to digital transmissions and were initially scheduled to be auctioned off for commercial broadband use. The FCC issued a third report and order, and fourth further notice of proposed rulemaking in an ongoing proceeding to set up the service. In addition, several related bills have been introduced into the new session of Congress, notably one by Senate Commerce Committee Chair Jay Rockefeller, Democrat of West Virginia, and another by House Homeland Security Committee Chairman Peter King, Republican of New York. According to the ARRL, King's bill, which is H.R. 607, includes a provision to provide alternative spectrum to commercial users who would lose potential frequencies through the creation of the emergency response network. Among the frequencies that would be subject to reallocation are 420 through 440 megahertz, part of the 70-centimeter band currently shared by amateurs and federal government relocation services such as PAVE PAWS radar. The ARRL has promised to fight that portion of Representative King's bill. Carrying some of those legislative thoughts further, the ARRL board adopts a legislative agenda. The ARRL Board of Directors has set forth 7 legislative priorities for the 112th Congress. According to the ARRL letter, point, including private land use regulations, such as CC&Rs, in the rule that currently requires local and state governments to, quoting, reasonably accommodate amateur radio operation. Point, opposing reallocation of amateur radio spectrum. Point, opposing laws that would favor unlicensed users over licensed users in shared spectrum. Point, seeking to have amateur radio's unique capabilities included in any legislation relating to emergency and disaster communications. Point, supporting other licensed services that need protection from interference for non-commercial purposes that benefit the public. Point, opposing distracted driving laws that do not exempt two-way radios operated by FCC licensees. And lastly, supporting the FCC Commissioner's Technical Resource Enhancement Act. The board also set up an ad hoc committee to monitor development of the National Broadband Plan and access possible threats to amateur frequencies. A California court has issued a mixed decision on the ham antenna case. A California appeals court has invalidated a municipal antenna ordinance as unenforceable because it was too vague. But told Palmdale amateur Alex Zubratiu, WB6X, that he would not be able to keep up his HF antenna. According to the ARRL letter, the court said that permitting Zubratiu to keep his VHF slant UHF vertical antenna constituted, quoting, reasonable accommodation because it allowed him to be active in some part of amateur radio. Montenegro added to FCC's reciprocity list. The Federal Communications Commission has added Montenegro to the list of European countries in which U.S. licensed hams may operate under the CEPT, that's the European Council of Postal and Telecommunications Administrations, Reciprocal Operating Agreement. The ARRL reports that the change took effect on February 7th of this year. Under CEPT rules, all amateur privileges are granted only to U.S. hams holding advanced or extra class licenses. General class hams receive limited CEPT novice privileges, while U.S. technicians and novices have no privileges in CEPT countries. Repeater donated to Radio Club de Haiti. A Vertex VXR7000 repeater, initially brought to Haiti as part of ARRL's relief efforts after last year's earthquake there, has been permanently donated to the Radio Club de Haiti through the efforts of the ARRL's Ham Aid Program and the Radio Club Dominico. The Dominican Republic shares the island of Hispaniola with Haiti. The ARRL letter reports that the repeater will be linked to other repeaters on the island as part of a plan to build a new nationwide amateur radio network. Brazilian hams lauded for relief efforts. The head of civil defense relief efforts in the aftermath of landslides and flooding in Brazil has praised local ham radio operators for their help. Newsline reports that Lieutenant Colonel Roberto Rabade told the BBC his command would not have been able to do anything in the first 2 days of the emergency if it were not for the hams. He said they set up their radio gear at key points to provide communications between relief groups. The landslides in late January were touched off by the heaviest rains the area has experienced in more than 4 decades. Nebraska ham critically injured in hit and run. Jeff Bierman, WB0M, is a news photographer for the Omaha World Herald newspaper and the ARRL public information coordinator for Nebraska. According to the ARRLN KETV News, Bierman was heading home from work in early February when his car was hit by a stolen SUV that ran a red light and then kept on going. The driver and the passenger were later apprehended. Bierman was rushed to the hospital in critical condition but is expected to recover. The ARRL says Get Well cards may be sent to Bierman's home address, but asks that no one send anything that would require a response or acknowledgement. Now for the editor's commentary. The editor's Rich Mawson called W2VU. Zero Bias, a CQ editorial. Orlando, Florida, home of sunshine, warm temperatures, a giant mouse named Mickey, and in mid-February, the second largest ham fest in the United States. We were there, as usual this year. We, this time, consisted of our new ad manager, Chip Margellis, K7JA, his wife, Janet, KL7MF, and me. We managed to avoid giant mouse encounters as well as most of the warmth and sunshine. It was cloudy and cool until it was time to leave on Sunday. But I was happy to be some place where there wasn't a foot or more of snow on the ground after a few days of melting. The Orlando Hamcation was its usual excellent self, bringing with it several signs of a slowly improving economy here in the United States and beyond. There seemed to be a larger contingent of hams from the Caribbean and Latin America than we've seen in several years. And those dealers selling lower-priced items did very, very well. Big-ticket items didn't really seem to be moving, though, suggesting that hams, like many others, are starting to spend money again, but slowly and carefully. As the economic picture continues to develop, I think we'll see resumed growth in the higher-cost items as well. Another good sign was the number of new or newly upgraded hams who came over after their test session for our special goodie bag. We regularly make this offer at hamfests and ask VE teams to direct successful candidates to our booth for their welcome packs. Typically, we'll get 6 to 8 people showing up with CSCEs, those Certificates of Successful Completion of Examination, in hand, asking what it's all about. This time we had at least 20, and about half were upgrades to general, the perfect audience for our HF Operator's Survival Guide, which is part of the package. Another sign of solid and steady growth within our hobby. Final Orlando note, thank you to our Facebook friends who stopped by and got a special discount. Look for special Facebook offers at future Hamfests where CQ is exhibiting. Speaking of Facebook, as I write this in mid-February, we are closing in on 5,000 fans on the CQ page there, 80% of whom are under age 55. Just some food for thought for those of you who believe we're all a bunch of old codgers. Back in November, I wrote about unimportant decisions I'd made about ham radio in my younger days and how they've influenced my life ever since. Apparently, I'm not alone. I heard from several readers who said that my story was very familiar to theirs. Quoting here, introduced to ham radio while in HS, it has influenced my entire life since 1953, wrote Bob Linker, W5SQA. Joe Schroeder, W9JUV, writes, I got intrigued with ham radio and became W9JUV in 1946. When I graduated from college in 1953, didn't know if I wanted to continue as a geologist, so thanks to a close high school ham radio friend, W9CPK, I went to work for Motorola Military instead. A fellow engineer, W9DDN, owned a Cessna 140 and invited me to tour the up of Michigan with him one weekend. A year later, I had a pilot's license and owned half the Cessna. When W9ZPK announced he was getting married, my mother decided we had to throw a party for Jim and his fiancée. He mentioned his fiancée knew this cute gal from Ohio, and since I was between girlfriends, maybe I'd like a blind date. I would, And 52 years later, she still puts up with me and even has a license, N9LGI. And on and on. Ham Radio Magazine and HR Report, ARRL, and AMSAT positions. Great life, great friends, great luck. Just had to share this with you. Thanks, Ham Radio. In this editorial, I also wrote about the impact of ham radio on those around us. William Cooper and Hugh9DE responded that back in 1974, he made a presentation on ham radio to a group of Cub Scouts, a few of whom were interested enough to get their novice licenses. One of the young men developed such an interest in electronics, he went to college and got a degree in electrical engineering, he wrote. The young man, William reports, is now vice president of technology of a major sporting goods firm, is still an active ham, and his wife and three children are all licensed as well. Even among those family members who do not become hams, our hobby still can have a tremendous impact. On page 26 of this issue, you'll find an article titled Next Tuesday, written by Claire Hyde, the adult granddaughter of W6EUF, who became a Silent Key last year. It shows the extent to which our hobby, our stations, and our call signs become wrapped up with our identities and how we are perceived by those around us. Soon after getting Claire's story ready for publication, I attended the funeral of an amateur here in New Jersey who was probably a lot like W6EUF, prominent in the local ham community, well-respected and well-loved by family, friends, and acquaintances from ham radio and other activities. At the service, one of his adult granddaughters delivered a lovely tribute to her grandfather. She managed to remain well composed as she described how he was known to different people in his life, family members, friends, and people he engaged with in different activities. She lost her composure, though, when she got to his ham radio call sign, and never really regained it. Realizing that she would not hear that call sign again became emblematic of her loss. I thought about it on the way home. Her reaction so similar to that expressed by Claire in her story. And I realized what makes ham radio unique as a hobby. Other activities in which we engage are things that we do. Ham radio becomes part of who we are. Maybe it's that unique call sign. Maybe it's something more. But clearly, we have something very special here. We need to nurture it and appreciate it. As WNIJUV says, thanks, Ham Radio. 73 W2VU, Rich Mawson, editor. Well, folks, we're already into early April, but I still have a couple of special event stations that are not yet on the air. I'll give them to you. First one is from Venice, Florida, special event call sign K4S Kilo 4 Sierra. From the Venice Sharks Tooth Festival, Venice, Florida, Tamiami Amateur Radio Club. It's April 8 through 10 on the various ham radio frequencies. Martinez, California, call K6M, Kilo 6 Mike. Martinez Amateur Radio Club operating April 16th from 1600 to 2300 from the John Muir House National Historic Site, in celebration of the 173rd birthday of John Muir, father of the National Parks System. Several hamfests are noted here. On April 9th, Spring Grove, Pennsylvania, York Hamfest, sponsored by the York Hamfest Foundation. It's located at the Porter Community Fire Company in Spring Grove, Pennsylvania. On April the 18th, in Cambridge, Massachusetts, a flea market at MIT, Massachusetts Institute of Technology, from 9 a.m. to 2 p.m. That's on Albany and Main Street in Cambridge, Massachusetts, sponsored by the Harvard Wireless Club, called W1AF, the MIT Electronics Research Society, the MIT UHF Repeater Association, W1MX. April 30th, Sonoma, California, Valley of the Moon Amateur Radio Club, call W6AJF ARRL Hamfest. And I'll give you one more as a reminder for May. May 20 through 22nd, Dayton, Ohio. The Dayton Hamvention, Hara Arena, 1001 Shiloh Springs Road, Dayton, Ohio. Now, for those of you who may be looking to buy a new handheld, there's a great review by one of our old friends, Gordon West, WB6NOA. It's a first look at the Kenwood TH-D72A handheld with GPS and APRS. It goes on for quite a few pages. Really, really well reviewed. So if you're thinking of putting a little money into something really fancy and very, very advanced, you ought to take a look at that article, have someone help you to read it if need be. And if you really want to be teased, at the very end of the article, a gentleman by the name of Don Arnold, called W6GPS, offers a 10-minute video guide to setting up and programming the THD-72A for APRS use. It's among several informative videos on his YouTube channel at http://www.youtube.com/W6GPS. Look for Basic Setup for APRS Operations with the Kenwood D72. A few moments ago in the editorial, there was mention made of the article Next Tuesday by Claire Hyde, H-Y-D-E. How does our hobby impact those closest to us? Even those who never catch the ham radio bug themselves. Maybe more than you think. Here is a touching example from the granddaughter of the late W6EUF. Next Tuesday, February 1, 2011, my grandmother would leave the Long Beach, California home where she'd lived for over 50 years with a list in her hand. She would have grocery shopping to do, the car washed, and probably would stop to get a small lunch while reading the newest novel she had borrowed from my aunt. She would not hurry. Rather, she would count her breaths as she walked. She would pace herself while choosing the ripest pear or the darkest plum. She would avoid going home until she must. You see, on that day, a man named Skip would come with his crane and begin the 3-day process of removing the 100-foot tower and antenna that belonged to my grandfather as long as he owned the home. These things had to be done, the shopping, car wash and lunch, and the removal of the tower and antennas. The taking down of the tower and its antennas is a symbol of the end of an era. It would be dismantled piece by piece, bolt and screw, foundation and support, until all that was left is a hole in the slab of the yard where my mother grew up, where I played on the porch, and where my daughter took some of her first timid steps. My grandfather, Wayne Gingrich, W6EUF, passed away in the late evening hours on June 16th of last year. For as long as he owned the home, the tower and antennas used for ham radio communications worldwide stood next to his house just north of the 405 freeway. Every Christmas he placed a well-lit star on the top of the tower, and it was known to everyone in the neighborhood areas as a landmark. I cannot count the times I used it as a beacon for direction, saying, "When you see the gigantic antenna, make sure you change lanes and exit." However, it was not just a landmark being removed. It is the end of an era in our lives and in the world of amateur radio. When his radio first was set up, before the 405 was even there, it was immediately hated by neighbors. It created interference with telephones and televisions, they said. It was an eyesore. It took my grandfather far into the night as he fidgeted with his hobby and became more adept at ham radio operations. As time passed, communications changed, and using that radio, my grandfather communicated with kings and princesses in lands most of us will never see, and made contact with cities in every country of the world. He established friendships with men in Sweden and Finland that spanned his lifetime. He became known for excellence in the craft of amateur radio operations and was recognized with countless awards and honors by his peers. During the Vietnam War, he would stay awake all night to use his station to connect soldiers overseas with their wives and children here in the United States, sometimes the only communication they could manage during deployment, sometimes their last communication with home. The dismantling of the tower was not just another perfunctory duty that was part of getting ready to sell the house someday. W6EUF was not going to sign on again. It means that the voice, the signal, of a little boy from Iowa who eventually saw the world from both the cockpit of airplanes in World War II and his own Cessna will no longer ring out in the midnight hours to establish contact in lands where his love of freedom and America will never again be sent from his station. Yet I know he is not alone in his love of the hobby, his country, freedom, and the wish to make contact with fellow hams worldwide. It means my Grandpa Wayne is really and truly gone. You may not notice the newly cleared sky, absent the tower and antennas of W6EUF, when you pass the Palo Verde exit on 405 while traveling to business meetings or to visit your friends and family. You might not miss the star shining brightly atop his tower during the holidays, and I know the neighbors will not miss the interference that never quite went away. However, there must definitely be a pocket of chatter hanging in the air, a place that smells faintly of cigar smoke and candied orange slices, where part of his heart still resides, the same part that is and will always be in me. It seems there are quite a few interesting articles in this month's issue of QST Magazine, folks, for April 2011. I don't often talk about QRP as a subject, particularly. QRP is the Q sign for very low power transmitting and receiving, or at least transmitting, 5 watts or less traditionally. There is one here I'll take a little bit of information from, something old, something new. QRP by Cam Hartford, call N6GA. This year, the QRP Amateur Radio Club International is celebrating its golden anniversary, 50 years. Started in 1961 by Harry Blomquist, K6JSS, its goal was to reduce QRM, that's noise, by limiting power output to 100 watts. This was at a time when kilowatt amplifiers were just beginning to become widely available. Later, the club officially embraced the 5-watt output level as the definition of QRP. The biggest and longest event scheduled to celebrate the anniversary of the club is the activation of the club call sign K6JSS from each of the 50 states, Puerto Rico, and the District of Columbia for 1 week during the year. The club is accepting volunteer members to act as operators or point persons to their respective states. As I'm writing this in early February of 2011, the states of Connecticut, Hawaii, Georgia, and Texas have participated. In Georgia alone, there were 985 QSOs, two-way conversations made by 25 operators. These contacts were made on CW, single sideband, and digital modes and took place on 10 different bands. According to Ken Evans, W4DU, president of QRP-ARCI, QRPers have sometimes been thought of as 40-meter CW crowd. These data show that they were pretty diverse when it comes to bands and modes. Many of the Georgia QSOs were QRP or QRO, very high power. Some joined the club as a result of their QRP QSO. Details about dates, times, and frequencies can be found on the QRPARCI website, which is www.qrpARCI.org/. There you can find the schedule of upcoming weeks of states, plus information regarding signing up to be an operator. Participants are also taking advantage of the QRP Spots website. This site is set up much like a DX spotting site, but is tailored to the QRP crowd. Self-spotting is encouraged so that a participant can announce his or her operating time frequency before the actual time arrives, thus giving those wishing to make contact with K6JSS stations a heads up of when and where to look. W4DU continues, other anniversary activities are in the works, but they do not present the opportunity to involve members nationwide as activating K6JSS. We are exploring having a QRP equipment display by a decade at FDIM211, 4 days in May, a special gathering of QRP enthusiasts that coincides with the Dayton Hamvention. Hopefully we will have gear from the 1960s, 70s, 80s, 90s, and the 2000s, both homebrew and commercial. Details are to be worked out in the next few weeks. Our FDIM speakers and themes will have Back to the Future embedded through the day, as we will have talks on crystal radio through SDR, software-defined radio, and weak signal reception. Our speakers will range from the vintage to a somewhat new 14-year-old amateur extra class. Plans will include a twist to our fall QSO party, but the details are still in the discussion phase. Congratulations to the QRP ARCI. Here's hoping the next 50 years will be as full of success and growth as the first 50. We have a column this month that tells us what's new. The author is John Wood, WV5J. He titles it, Spring Brings New Products to the Market. It's quite lengthy and very interesting, but I'm going to pick a couple of categories to talk about. First is Book Corner. We Be Big. Amateur radio plays a major part in the new book written by the stars of the nationally syndicated radio program, The Rick and Bubba Show, and co-written by another ham, Don Keith, call in 4KC. Bill, Bubba, Bossy, KJ4JJ, and his show partner, Rick Burgess, along with Keith, have written the title, We Be Big, subtitled The Mostly True Story of How Two Kids from Calhoun County, Alabama, Became Rick and Bubba. It's the autobiography of Burgess and Bussy, whose morning radio show was heard in over 50 American cities, as well as on XM satellite radio. The team previously had published several books that landed near the top on the New York Times bestseller list. The successful Rick and Bubba show features their dome home view on life in what is described as a spirited and funny presentation. The amateur radio connection comes from several angles. Bussy is a longtime active ham radio operator who holds an advanced class license and the call sign KJ4JJ. He cites amateur radio as an influence that led him to his career in broadcast engineering, ownership, and on-the-air success. In the book, Bussy talks about how he came to the hobby at an early stage and has been an active ham ever since. He also often talks about amateur radio on the show. Additionally, We Be Big was co-written with the help of national best-selling author and extra-class license holder Don Keith, call N4KC. He is a member of the American Radio Relay League and has been licensed for almost 50 years. Keith has over 20 books in print, both fiction and nonfiction, and writes on subjects such as college athletics, broadcasting, submarines, and World War II history. Keith was also a longtime broadcaster, twice named Billboard Magazine's Broadcast Personality of the Year. He maintains a website with articles for others interested in the hobby of ham radio and blogs on the subject of technological change and its effect on media and amateur radio. Another publication of significant interest for many of you could be this one, ARRL, American Radio Relay League Field Day Handbook for radio amateurs. If April is here, can June be far away? Not when you're talking about field day and making plans for the big event, June 25 and 26, 1800 hours through 2100 hours Zulu. With a comprehensive guide for this largest on-the-air annual operating event in amateur radio be handy? If you said yes, then you need to know that the ARRL now has a guide available to help you. And it's called the ARRL Field Day Handbook for Radio Amateurs. It's pictured on page 94 of April 2011 CQ Mag. The ARRL tells us that this book includes everything you need to know to participate in this annual event, including general operating rules, logbooks, ARRL field day rules, and U.S. amateur radio band chart, field day antenna projects, and more. Also in the book, you'll find the Considerate Operator's Guide, ARRL slant RAC section abbreviations, an ARRL slant RAC map, tips for field day power, and field day public relations. That's how to publicize your event before and after the big day. Amateur satellites and HF digital communications. The guide also includes a bevy of how-to antenna projects such as the Moxon rectangle, a simple HF portable antenna, a portable two-element tri-band Yagi, one stealthy delta, a 30 and 40-meter trap dipole, a ground-coupled portable antenna, the NJQRP squirt beam antennas, the Arkansas catfish dipole, a lightweight monobander for 14 megahertz, a simple VHF slant UHF satellite antenna, a portable tri-band Yagi, a portable twin-band 20-meter dipole, a one-masted sloop for 40, 20, 15, and 10 meters, and a horizontal loop for 80 meters. The ARRL Field Day Handbook for Radio Amateurs sells fairly close to a very reasonable price, and it's available at www.arrl.org. And while you're at it, if you're a ham with less or lower than general class license privileges, there's also an ARRL General Class License Manual available from them. It's the sixth edition of the General Class Manual. And I suppose it's said to be everything you need to pass your General Class License exam. That's the license that gives its holder a smorgasbord of limited operating frequencies on most amateur bands. Frequent listeners to these commentaries in the Diff and Digest magazines that I record for the ham community know that there are always contests out there. Well, we have an article about that. It's Contesting by George Trainus, call in to GA. Contesting with groups and clubs. Contesting can be an isolated activity with many hours spent cooped up alone. Those who participate in the single operator category are most likely to have limited social contact. It is interesting that we can feel so secluded when partaking in the hobby that puts us in touch with so many people. However, that does, in fact, occur. There are a few different ways to address this concern. Whichever you choose, all are guaranteed to get you out of your standalone rut. One of the easiest ways to change your routine is to join a multi-operator contest effort. You will share the camaraderie of a like-minded group of contesters and hopefully will experience a different angle of contesting. Multi-operator efforts can range from extremely casual to very planned and structured. Those taking the low-key approach may just join in and operate together or simply take turns operating. For a newcomer, this is a good way to observe more experienced hams and get a feel for operating proficiency. A great example of this is seen at many field day sites where newbies are paired with seasoned veterans to observe, log contacts, and operate. Some people new to contesting limit their operating to tuning the bands and answering other calling stations. They may be afraid to take the next step and try their hand at calling CQ themselves. Having a mentor nearby for support and assistance can help this person feel more comfortable as he or she gets used to the rhythm of running stations. It can be intimidating at first, especially if the call sign is missed or more than one person is answering. Having a backup operator there with a steady voice to help out and guide you can be very reassuring. Once the initial trepidation fades and confidence is instilled, the new operator can relax and begin to enjoy being on the other side of the pileup. Being in a multi-operator environment can help folks unaccustomed to more competitive operating. Joining a multi-op effort sometimes also provides access to bigger stations, higher antennas, and more sophisticated switching and filtering. For someone who normally operates barefoot with a dipole, stepping up to this type of station can be an eye-opening experience. The pace and fun multiplies as your effective radiator power increases. More stations will answer your calls. You'll spend less time waiting for a response, and many additional contacts will be put into the log. Access to better antennas and high-end radios will allow second and third-tier stations to become more easily workable. This can lead to higher rates, more exchanges, more multipliers, and higher scores. As your results get better, some groups may become much more serious. They will study the propagation predictions and make a band plan to guide them to what frequencies they want to be on and when. An operator schedule can also help and provide a broad overview of who will be operating and at what time. This can assure that all hours of the contest are covered. Even if you've never operated an entire contest by yourself, it is easily doable with proper planning when you operate at a multi-station. This planning can also lead to more awareness of unusual openings. Multi-operator efforts also normally have access to DX spotting networks, and these can help identify when a rare opening is occurring. This can put many additional multipliers in your log or allow you to run high rates during normally slow times. Having someone else on hand to help out can allow one operator to concentrate on the optimal run band while others perform checks on the other bands for uncommon conditions or rare multipliers. Different issues will arise when you are at a multi. Once you decide, you will be operating the entire contest. Sleeping and eating become important considerations. Does the contest station have room for operators to sleep? If not, where will they sleep? Is there a place for preparing and eating food? What food will you eat? Will you buy food and prepare it on site, or bring already prepared food? In some places, additional helpers will be on hand to make food, serve it, and clean up. Other helpers may provide technical assistance if something breaks or logistical support. There is no limit to the amount of assistance that can be provided on site at a multi-operation. Operating with a group of people who have the same goals and share a common experience can be rewarding. You should feel a sense of accomplishment when the contest is over. If everyone enjoys themselves, then the group might consider repeating the experience with another contest. Post-contest analysis could provide insight into areas of strength and weakness and help foster a discussion of future improvements. Working as a team, individuals can both contribute to the group cause and take satisfaction from their own participation. It is common at many large multi-operator stations to have a core of prime-time operators, some relief operators, station builders, computer experts, RF gurus, cooks, technical assistants, and other helpers. The team can be successful as long as everyone gets something out of the experience. Radio clubs are a venue where the single op entrant can contribute to a common cause and still operate independently. Radio clubs come in all types and sizes. Large, general interest type clubs may not care about contesting, and there may be very little talk about anything that is contest related. Even DX clubs may not be that interested in contesting except as a means to an end. working that next rare country. You may meet some contesters who belong to these types of clubs, but if you want to really get immersed in the intricacies of competitive amateur radio operating, then you need to find a contest-specific club. Contest clubs can be local, regional, or even national. And here are a few examples. The Slovenian Contest Club and the Deutscher Amateur Radio Club are great examples of large clubs with members from an entire country. Regional clubs, such as the Yankee Clipper Contest Club, the Florida Contest Group, and the Society of Midwest Contesters, are examples of regional contest clubs. The Hudson Valley Contesters and DXers and the Order of Boiled Owls of New York are just two examples of local contest clubs. Many dyed-in-the-wool contesters belong to multiple contest clubs, as all have something different to offer. So in summary, being a part of a multi-operator group of contest clubs can get you out of your shack and help contribute to a larger cause. While it's great to be alone behind a microphone or key during a contest, it can be more fun to share your passion with others. After all, didn't you get into contesting to contact people? There is no better way to interact with others than to do it in a group setting. Multiple operator teams and contest clubs provide connections, idea exchanges, and communication to help you achieve your goals. That's Contesting by George Tranis. Call N2GA. He signed 73 George. Here's an interesting article. With the springtime and coming out to nice weather in the summer, radio fox hunting season brings medals and merriment. The author is Joe Moell, M-O-E-L-L. Joe's call is K-0-O-V. So let's share just a little bit from this particular article about radio fox hunting. You've worked a bunch of new countries in CQ's Worldwide DX and WPX contests. You've competed against your fellow hams in CQ's 160-meter, RTTY, that's R-T-T-Y teletype, and VHF contests. But have you gotten out of the shack and participated in CQ's Worldwide Fox Hunting Weekend? Every year, as the weather warms up, CQ Magazine encourages its readers to join together with other hams and would-be hams for a day or an evening of fun with Radio Direction Finding, RDF. Get some fresh air and good physical exercise by looking for hidden transmitters on foot in a nearby forest or a local park. You'll be doing what radio athletes around the world do, and you might get good enough at it to become a medal winner at a national or worldwide competition. If physical exercise isn't your thing, try RDF, Radio Direction Finding Contesting, in your car, truck, or van. It's not hard to mount a VHF antenna, so you can turn it to get bearings as you drive along. You'll have a great time, and you'll be learning a skill that could prove to be valuable when it's time to find interference on your favorite repeater or simplex frequency. After more than half-century, mobile transmitter hunting, sometimes called T-hunting, is still the most popular form of radio fox hunting in the United States. To win a mobile T-hunt, a vehicular team must locate one or more radio foxes before the others, or do it with least mileage added to the odometer. The winning criterion depends on the local hunt rules, and so does the reward. The best team usually wins the job of transmitting next time. That can be just as much fun. Will you find a perfect hiding location to keep the mobile hunters driving for hours? You may ask, why was this growing ham radio activity named after the centuries-old horse and hounds sport that is now banned in Britain? Nobody knows for sure. It probably started in Northern Europe and Scandinavia, where on-foot transmitter hunting with 80-meter loops and portable receivers began in the early 1950s. It spread throughout the continent and became a regular activity among youths, particularly in the former Soviet Union and Soviet satellite countries. Before long, there were regular international contests using uniform rules developed by a committee of the International Amateur Radio Union. Those rules have been modified over the years to add to and revise the age, gender categories, improve starting procedures, and so forth. Besides on-foot fox hunting, the sport is known worldwide as fox tailing, radio orienteering, and amateur radio direction finding, the acronym ARDF. A champion ARDF course has 5 transmitters scattered in a forested area that can encompass thousands of acres. Typical distance from the start to each transmitter in optimum sequence to the finish is 5 kilometers or more. Transmitter 1 is on for 60 seconds. Then it goes off and transmitter 2 comes on for a minute. Then 3, and so forth, until the cycle repeats after number 5. Knowledge of the code is not necessary because the number of dits tells which transmitter is on. There is no mass start in Championship ARDF. Each person is timed individually from start to finish. Groups of competitors take off at 5-minute intervals that correspond to the times that transmitter 1 comes on the air. Each person competes on 2 courses on separate days, one on 2 meters and one on 80 meters. The optimum order for finding transmitters with minimum distance traveled is up to the competitors to figure out, based on the signal strengths and bearings they get when they start. Hunters are not permitted to give clues to one another on the course, even if they are on the same national team. Individual scores of team members are added to determine team rankings. In 1998, the United States sent its first delegation to the ARDF-WC World Contest. One of the 6 travelers was Dennis Schwendner, WB6OBB, of Santa Barbara, California, who was blind. Dennis knew that he could not be in the competition at that time, but he was happy to cheer our fledgling team and to be a tourist. In 2010, Dennis again went to the ARDFWC, but this time as a competitor. One of the activities in the Poticcio was the first ARDFWC for the blind. In addition to Dennis, the competition field included 13 visually impaired persons from Croatia, 3 from Bosnia and Herzegovina, and 1 from Germany. Since some of them had a small amount of sight, they were required to wear opaque goggles. A championship blind ARDF course has 5 transmitters in a flat, grassy area such as a soccer field. They are on the 80-meter band, which is more suitable than 2 meters because receiver antenna sets are smaller and signal reflectors are usually non-existent. Competitors take on the course one at a time. When the start signal is given, fox number 1 is already on the air, and the competitor heads out to find it. There is an 8-foot radius circle in chalk or tape around the vertical transmitting antenna. Stepping into this circle constitutes a find. Called WB6OBB placed 4th in the category for men over age 50, finding all 5 transmitters in less than 5 minutes. That was an excellent showing against the well-practiced Croatians. He credits it to his many years of experience in direction finding, both in cars and on foot. He had won USA's first ARDF National Championship for the Blind at Dayton Hamvention in 2007. Is there a future radio-oriented champion among your club members? Even if there isn't, a fox hunting weekend hunt would be a great family activity. Imagine the fun of a dozen club members spreading out in a search of a half dozen mini foxes, all on different frequencies, in a local park or schoolyard. Be sure that the kids, grandkids, nieces, and nephews of all members are invited. They don't need driver's licenses or ham license to receive signals and to hunt them. For many clubs, fox hunting weekend kicks off a season of regular transmitter hunts. For others, it's a once-a-year event, like field day. CQ doesn't impose any rules or offer any prizes for Fox Hunting Weekend. That's up to you and your fellow hometown hams. You don't even have to schedule it on May 14th and 15th of this next month. Any weekend in the spring will be fine. If your club has never done mobile tea hunts, it's easy to get started. All you need is a willing volunteer with a 2-meter radio. Tell him or her to find an unusual location and start transmitting at the appointed hour. A good time for your club's first hunt might be a weekday evening right after a net, when the local repeater has lots of listeners. Automated fox boxes are nice, but not mandatory. From the hiding place, the designated fox operator can simply make frequency transmissions on the repeater input, urging every listener to get in the car and participate. It's good to declare small boundaries, such as a county or part of it. After a while, help fledgling hunters by announcing smaller boundaries or giving other clues. The first mobile tea hunts should be easy enough that everyone is successful and encouraged. The signal should be strong, and the transmitter should be in plain sight, perhaps in the parking lot of a restaurant or on a table in a city park. Give them a challenge, but don't make it mission impossible. With a few short hunt successes, everyone will be eager to try longer-range hunts. It's best to hold them on the simplex frequency rather than tie up a repeater for long periods of time. Hiders will quickly learn to use tricks such as camouflage and controlled signal reflections. Planning hunts and building RFD gear can be almost as much fun as the actual transmitter tracking. Start your search at my website, www.homingin.com, which has the announcement of this year's Fox Hunting Weekend, an article on mobile tea hunting that you can put in your club's newsletter, and ideas for equipment that will make a fox hunter out of anyone with a 2-meter handy talkie. Most every member of your club is a potential participant in Fox Hunting Weekend. Better yet, include the whole community, especially young people. Invite a scout troop to experience on-foot transmitter tracking or to ride along with the mobile hunters. Look for opportunities to incorporate fox hunting into scout activities such as camporees, scout-oramas, and jamboree on the air. Whatever your club's RDF contesting style, be sure to keep safety in mind. Don't put transmitters where someone might get hurt getting to them. Make sure that all transmitting and receiving antennas are eye safe. Always be mindful of your own physical limitations and never take chances behind the wheel or in the forest. Afterwards, write up the results and send them to me. The list of information in a complete CQ Fox Hunting Weekend report is posted with the announcements at my website. We need details of dates, location, hiders, and winners. Readers also want to know what was unique about your hunt and what lessons, positive or negative, you've learned from it. Take lots of photos for your club newsletter and please send some to me for a follow-up article. Although digital files are best, sharp 5x7 prints may be usable. Resolution of 640x480 is the bare minimum. A camera of 4 to 10 megapixels give images that will make the editors much happier and will be more likely to be used. The author of this contesting article, Joe Moell, M-O-E-L-L, call K0OV, Kilo Zero Oscar Victor, is the American Radio Relay League's ARDF coordinator and moderator of the annual CQ Worldwide Fox Hunting Weekend. He also writes the Homing In columns on radio direction finding topics for CQ VHF magazine. His Homing In website is www.homingin.com. If you have internet capabilities and you'll get interested in this contesting thing, you could go to that Homing In website, and there's plenty of information and ideas about radio direction finding equipment and techniques. Ladies and gentlemen, this brings me up to time for this month's Reading and Digest format for CQ Magazine for April 2011. CQ is published by CQ Communications Incorporated, 25 Newbridge Road, Hicksville, New York, 11801. This recording is a production of the Courage Anti-Amp System, 3915 Golden Valley Road, Golden Valley, Minnesota, 55422. It is for the use of eligible Handy Ham members only. Any other use may violate copyright laws. Handy Hams may be reached at area 763-520-0512 or at email address handyham@courage.org. The website is www.handyham.org. Your reader, my name is Bob Zeta. My call is N1BLF, November 1, Bravo, Lima, Foxtrot. My location, or QTH, is Dartmouth, Massachusetts. Have a great spring and a fine summer to come. 73.